Welcome to night 21 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights, as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we are featuring the first of three special episodes from the tale of the Humpback, which is the fourth chapter of the 1001 Nights tales. In this episode, Matthew William, the podcast creator and author of The Enoch Pill, will be offering his interpretation of the Christian broker's tale. Now, last chapter, we told you a story that lasted for 10 episodes. It was interweaving and it was exciting, and I'm so glad we did it, but I think it was difficult to follow. So this episode, and then for the next several episodes, what we're doing is we're taking a chapter that's even longer and perhaps more complex, and we're giving you one shots. Episodes that are self-contained or stories that last for only a couple episodes, rather than trying to tell a narrative within a narrative within a narrative, which, while artistically and creatively interesting, can be confusing and somewhat convoluted, especially on the listener's side. So we are offering the Christian Broker's Tale as a standalone. You will hear the whole thing this episode, and it's a really wonderful story. I hope you enjoy. Scheherazade has just finished the tale of the porter and the ladies of Baghdad.
Would you like to hear another story, my love?
She begins another story, telling the Sultan about a humpback who choked on a fishbone, and whose body, in a series of strange events, ends up in many people's backyards and homes. Each time, the discoverers of the body mistakenly thinking they are responsible for his death. And she tells of how all those who thought they were responsible found themselves in a familiar situation, having to tell fantastic stories to save their lives. And she tells of how the Christian broker began to tell his most exciting story.
Hold on. I've got a story that's really going to knock your socks off. It all started about a year ago while I was working at an eBay shop. Now, in case you don't know, eBay shops are set up to sell things online for old people, from women's vintage dresses that the passing of decades had brought back into style to classic baseball cards unearthed from old men's basements, which hadn't seen the light of day since their youth, and hopefully all that time had made them worth something. But without fail, all of our clientele were of the older persuasion. Old enough to not know how to use eBay comfortably. And so, for a percentage, we would sell their treasures for them. But then one day, this young guy comes walking into the shop straight out of a GQ catalog. He couldn't have been more than 28 or 29. Good-looking guy, dressed in a beautiful Italian suit and a tan Ralph Lauren overcoat. Sunglasses, slick hair, expensive cologne. I go in for a handshake, but he keeps the right hand jammed into his pocket, and with his left, he throws a key onto my desk. You see that car out there? He pointed out the window to a gorgeous red 1968 Corvette convertible sitting in the parking lot. I want you to sell it for me. I can do that, I said. When he goes out to get the papers, I ask my manager, we sell cars, right? We didn't. But on account of the gorgeous red Corvette, he'd be willing to make an exception. The kid, Sean Young was his name, signs all the paperwork and says that he'll be back in a month to collect on the sale. The one thing I never stopped to ask myself was, why doesn't he just sell the car himself? I go and I get the Corvette appraised, and it turned out to be a rare model in mint condition and worth $500,000. Yeah, that's right. $500,000. I almost had a stroke. I put it up for auction and sold it in just a few days. A month passed, but Sean Young never came back to collect his money. And stupid me, in the heat of the moment, I had forgotten to collect his cell phone number. So I wait a little longer. Another month passes, and another, and another. All the while, I have my manager breathing down my neck because we have this huge sum of money sitting on the ledger, screwing up the account month after month. I tell you, it was a stolen car, he'd say. And I tell him, if it was stolen, he probably would have come back for the money already. So, eventually, my boss makes me take the money. It's now my responsibility to hold on to until Sean Young comes back. So I do what any responsible adult would do. I play it in the stock market. It was not one of my proudest moments, but I figured, when in life will I ever have this kind of capital to play with? And I won big. I was able to squeeze another $20,000 out of that money over the next couple of months. But then one day, Sean Young comes walking back into the shop. And I'm like a deer in the headlights. All his money is tied up in stocks and equities. Nervously, I go to shake his hand, but he shakes with his left, keeping his right jammed into his pocket. I'm trying to distract both him and my manager, making a really big deal about the average weather we've been having, all the while on my computer frantically trying to sell the stocks. If they find out, at best I'd be fired. Who knows what Sean Young would do to me? So I ask Sean if I can take him to lunch, since I made so much on the Corvette sale. And he knows just by looking in my eyes that something is wrong. So he agrees, and his driver takes us in his limo to the bistro downtown. We got there and sat down, but he kept on his tan overcoat and kept his right hand shoved in his pocket. "Aren't you warm?" I asked. He just shrugged. When the menu came, he flipped it through with his left hand, the right still hidden away. It's at this point that I started to get worried. I'm sure he's got a gun in there, and he's going to shoot me for taking his money. He doesn't order any food, just a Bloody Mary. I look at my watch. It's 10 a.m. This guy is definitely going to shoot me. So I figure if I'm going to go, I might as well make it uncomfortable for him. "What's in the pocket?" I asked. "Nothing," he says, shocked I even asked. "Well, it's gotta be something." "It's nothing." "Can I see then if it's nothing?" Reluctantly, he pulls out his hand, and my blood runs cold. He had no hand at all. It was cut off at the wrist. Nothing summed it up perfectly. "Is this because of the car?" I ask automatically. "This is because of the most beautiful girl in the world." "She cut off your hand?" "No. I guess I should start from the beginning," he said. And once his Bloody Mary came, he told me everything. My dad died, and I inherited this warehouse full of dresses. Since I didn't know a thing about the business, I gave a whole lot to a distributor in the garment district to sell on consignment. I would head down there on Fridays to pick up a check for anything they sold during the week. And one Friday, while I was in there talking to the shop owner, I saw her. Man, she was a knockout. Sean Young shook his head in disbelief. Eyes like lightning, and ass like you wouldn't believe. I'd go on, but the words wouldn't do her justice. And she's there buying some of my dresses, and her card gets declined. She storms out. And so I take the dresses, pay the shop owner Valentino his share, and chase her down the sidewalk. I give them to her and explain I'm not just some creep, but I sincerely want her to have them. And now up to this point, I'd never seen her smile. Valentino said he'd never seen her once smile to him or anyone else. But when I give her those dresses, she is beaming from ear to ear. "What's your name?" I asked. "Zoe," she said. A great name. Probably the best name for a beautiful girl. Anyway, her assistant, who is this terrible middle-aged wench with a stick up her butt, is telling her that she'll be late for a meeting if she doesn't leave right then and there. And so we had to part. I walk back to the shop on cloud nine, and I ask Valentino, "Who is she?" He says that she's some senator's daughter. He just passed away, leaving her a fortune. Me and her were in the same boat, suddenly rich because our dads are dead. I asked if he had her phone number. "Even if I did," he said, "a girl like that, you better ask for yourself if you want to have any chance with her." I went home when I tossed and I turned all night just thinking about her. It was like a splinter in my brain. But I had no way of finding her. So in the morning, I went back to the shop because that's the one place I know she goes. And she's there again, buying another one of my dresses. I walk up and I tell Valentino that she can have this one for free too. I pay him his fee and, again, Zoe is all smiles. That girl never smiles to anyone. And right on cue, her assistant, Mrs. Stick-Up-Her-Butt, is in her ear again, telling her that she has to go. And I'm watching her leave. Kitty, you stupid, go make your move! So I chased him down and said something stupid like, I don't think I'll ever forgive myself if I don't get your number, or it would be the biggest mistake of my life. Something cheesy like that. But somehow it worked. She had her assistant put her number into my phone while we were just staring into each other's eyes. I go back to Valentino to show off my victory. But when I show him my phone, he kind of squints at it and says, get lost. What? That's what she wrote. Get lost. And a bunch of zeros for a number. No! I look at the screen. That friggin' assistant! That's cold, man. Do you have any way to contact her? All I got is the address for her credit card. You gotta let me have it, I pleaded. I can't do that. Confidentiality. Please. He groaned, but then he noticed something at the front door that scared him. I turned to see a couple of shady-looking guys in pinstripe suits and pinky rings entering the store. If I give it to you, you'll get out of here? I nodded, and he scribbled the address on a receipt. I took a cab. But when I arrived, the house was full of construction workers. I asked a guy carrying in some 2x4s if Zoe was home.
Not for another 3 months. We're gutting the whole place.
That leveled me. She was lost again. I sat down on the sidewalk and tried to think of what to do next. Suddenly, a limo pulled up, and when the window went down, guess who it was?
Mrs. Stick-Up-Her-Butt herself.
She didn't seem too happy to see me.
Get in the car, she said.
I was confused, but I did what she said, and once I was in, the car pulled off.
Zoe was sure you'd be here, she said. She asked if I gave you the right number, and since I don't make a habit of lying to my boss, I told her no. I also told her that she is now the owner of a small fortune and that all sorts of lowlifes will be crawling out of the woodwork to get that money. I'm an astute judge of character. I know that's what you're after.
It's not about the money.
No.
I just got an inheritance myself, I said, believing that a warehouse full of dresses was equal to a fortune.
Is that a fact?
Yes.
Well, we'll see about that. Zoe seems to be taken with you, but I won't let you screw up her future.
The car stopped.
Where are we? I asked.
Her hotel, the assistant said.
She wanted to see you. Room 332.
I get out, and it's the Mandarin Oriental on the Upper West Side. I go inside, and the place is stunning. Marble floors, a chandelier in the lobby. I felt like I didn't belong. But Zoe was there waiting for me, and she ran up and kissed me on the mouth.
Is it really you? She asked.
Yeah, it's me, I said. We go up to her room.
There's something about you, she said. Like you're somebody I've known for a long time, but you can't be. We just met.
I feel that too, I said. I can't explain it.
What should we do about it?
We spent the night making love and ordering all sorts of crazy room service. Lobster, champagne, caviar, you name it. If it was expensive, we ordered it. And we stayed up all night talking about our recently departed fathers. What's the happiest memory you have of your dad? I asked her.
When he took me to Disney World for my birthday, she said without a moment's hesitation. I never got to spend so much time with him. He was always on the road or in his office. But for those few days, he was all mine. I had 100% of his attention. It was all I ever wanted. She was quiet for quite a while, just living in that old memory.
What about you?
I didn't even have to think. When I was 16, he bought me a beautiful 1968 red Corvette. It was kind of his midlife crisis car. And he brought it home and it was out polishing it in the garage. It was the first time I think I ever saw him proud of something that he had accomplished. I asked if I could take it for a test drive, and he let me. We went around the block. He sat all nervous in the passenger seat. I still can't believe he let me do it. But that's what meant so much, that he actually trusted me with something so precious to him. He had to sell it years later when he got sick. That was the first time I saw him helpless. Then the cancer finished the job. She held me tight and kissed me softly. Soon the morning came, and along with it, the bill for the room service. 10 rand. Her assistant's words from the day before echoed in my ears, so I offered to pay for it all. Fortunately, I'd just gotten a card without a spending limit.
"Are you sure?"
Zoe asked. "Of course," I said. "You're not the only one around here with money." As we exchanged phone numbers for real this time, leaving each other was the hardest thing we ever had to do. Night after night, it was the same thing again and again. An endless array of lovemaking and champagne and caviar and secrets. I paid for it all. It made me feel invincible. Until one morning, I woke up and I realized I was flat broke. My savings, my checking account, my credit card maxed to the rafters. And on top of all that, my rent was due. The only hope I had was to go to the shop in the garment district. Hopefully, they had sold a few dresses during the week. As I go in, I notice Valentino was in the back office with two of the guys in the pinstripe suits. He looked scared, real scared. I knocked on the door. Valentino excused himself and came to see me. "You shouldn't be here right now." "Sorry, I just need to collect whatever you owe me."
"What are you talking about?"
"I need the money," I said.
"No, I mean, you're all out, kid. There's nothing left."
"You're kidding."
"No, I'm not. Look here."
He opened the register to show me my final receipts. "You collected the other week. I told you that was the last of it, but you had your head in the clouds and on the phone with what's-her-name." What was I gonna do?
"Can you just give me an advance?" I asked.
"We don't do advances," he said, as he put the stack of receipts back into the register. That's when I noticed a small stack of cash sitting there, waiting.
"Now look, you bring in more dresses, maybe we can talk. Until then, you gotta get out of here. I have some business to attend to."
He shoos me away and goes into the back room with the other two men. One of them glares at me as Valentino closes the door. Just then, I get a message from Zoe.
"Meet me tonight. I have a surprise for you."
I needed that money. I needed another night. It had become like a drug to me. And what happened next, I guess I'll gloss over. I tried to get into the register. I actually get it open and take the cash. Guys in the back must have seen me on some security camera because they come out and grab me as I'm trying to run. They were members of the mob protecting the place. Valentino is pleading with them not to do what they're about to do, but they're not hearing any of it. They take me out back and they tell me they're gonna show me what they do to thieves in Palermo. And they took out a gun and unloaded 8 shots into my right hand. "Hopefully you think twice before sticking your hand in the cookie jar," the one says. They leave and Valentino's crying and I'm about to black out. There's so much blood. We wrapped my hand in a dress, and he drove me to the ER. The police came and had to fill out a report. It was a huge mess. In the end, the doctors couldn't even save the hand. It had taken too much damage. Valentino gave me the cash that was in the drawer. I didn't want to take it. After I was released the next morning, I took a cab to Zoe's. When she opened the door, I was standing there looking like I'd just walked off a battlefield. My arm was hidden away in a sling.
"What happened?"
she kept asking me. "Nothing," I said. "It's okay." I don't know how long I thought I could hide it from her. I had lost a lot of blood. She brings me inside and gives me water, and I pass out on the bed. I guess while I was asleep, she peeked under the bandages and saw what had happened to me. When I awoke, she was sitting on the floor, crying, shaking, white as a ghost.
"It's my fault, isn't it?"
she asked. "It's not your fault at all."
"Yes, it is. I should have never let you spend all that money."
"How do you know it was even about money?"
"You would have told me what happened already."
She came over and wrapped her arms around me and begged me to forgive her. "There's nothing to forgive," I said, and I squeezed her as hard as I could with my left arm. "I'm on the list for a transplant already." She laughed and sobbed.
"I guess I should show you your surprise."
She brought me down to the garage, and what was sitting there? The red 1968 Corvette convertible. just like my dad's. I stood there, dizzy and dazed. I couldn't believe my eyes. Zoe was crying.
All your money is right there. Whatever you spent, I put into an account and I bought this. I'm such an idiot.
You're not an idiot.
I feel like one. Let's go to Disney, I said.
And so we drove down to Florida and forgot about everything for a week. That may have been the happiest I've ever been. In the Magic Kingdom, high on painkillers, missing my goddamn right hand.
Sean Young smiled and shook his head. He started to laugh, and then he went deadly serious and looked out the window.
You know that feeling you have right before something ends? You try to hold on for dear life, but it's going, slipping right through your fingers. I tried to help her, but her grief over what happened to me just took over. She took 27 sleeping pills one night, and there was nothing I could do.
I'm so sorry, I said.
His eyes went red and he started to cry.
She left me everything, the house, the Corvette, everything. Pissed off her assistant to no end. But I've been selling it all off. I can't stand to see a single thing that reminds me of her.
He was quiet for a minute.
I was coming here today to collect the money from the car. That's the last thing. But it feels like, well, that money was never mine to begin with. I want you to take it. You think you could do that?
Slowly, I picked my jaw up off the floor and nodded. He signed all the papers while I kept asking him if he was sure.
I'm as sure as anything I ever done, he said.
He gave me a ride back to the eBay store in his limo. We were both quiet, just thinking about everything that had happened. Finally, I asked him, would you change anything?
What do you mean?
He asked. I mean, would you do anything different? And he said,
I was trying to be something I'm not. That was my mistake.
And he let me out, and I never saw him again. Needless to say, I retired from my servitude at the eBay store, paid off my student loan, and have been on the road ever since. That's how I wound up here, telling you this tale. Now, if that's not the craziest story you've ever heard, I don't know what is.
The Sultan, however, did not find the story as unlikely as the tale of the humpback's demise at the hands of multiple people throughout the neighborhood. Another one of the accused, the Sultan's own steward, stepped up and began to tell his tale in hopes that it would impress the Sultan enough to allow them all to live. However, we will tell that story tomorrow night. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is voiced by the incredibly talented Ariel Siegel. Tonight's story was written by Matthew William. He has a podcast of his own. It's called The Enoch Pill, and I absolutely recommend checking it out. It is about a world in which there is a pill that allows everyone to live forever, except for our protagonist, who is the only person in the world immune to the pill's effects, the only person destined to grow old and die. Definitely worth checking out. The music in the 1001 Nights podcast is generously contributed by Heyvan Lar Alemi, Eric Hopton, and Pharaoh's Daughter. Next week, we are honored and excited to have a story by Mac Barnett. He will be retelling the tale of the Sultan's Steward. To find out more about the 1001 Nights podcast, visit us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. Here at the 1001 Nights podcast, we are so lucky to have Ariel Siegel as our Scheherazade. She's so talented and she's doing so many amazing things, from being amazingly funny in her own sketches to being featured on commercials to audiobooks. My only complaint is that her assistant is completely unreasonable. I mean, just the other day, we finished an episode and I was trying to chat for a bit.
And right on cue, her assistant, Mrs. Stick-Up-Her-Butt, is in her ear again, telling her that she has to go. And I'm watching her leave.
Hollywood big shots. What are you gonna do? All right, thank you so much for listening, and good morning.